I'm happy to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Mark Shapiro. He's an investigative reporter, longtime environmental journalist, and his new book is called Carbon Shock, a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of the disrupted global economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks, and great to be back, too.
Yeah, we've got you by phone. Wish you were here in the cafe again.
Me too. I'd have some good Santa Fe coffee.
Yeah. So this is a book about the economics of climate change and about very big questions like when someone creates a problem, who pays for the damages? And how do you do this on a global scale across national boundaries? First of all, let's talk about the economic damages of climate change. They're not some hypothetical future. They're already here. What are some examples in areas like agriculture and human health?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, this is one of the primary reasons I wrote the book, was to identify how we're already paying the costs of climate change. There's a sense that it's going to be, you know, decades away and all that. So I'll tell you, I spent a lot of time with, I went to different parts of the world to actually go to where those costs are being experienced, you know, vividly. One of the areas I went up and down the Central Valley of California of farming, but I'll tell you, one of the most interesting things that I learned in the course of doing the book was that the crop insurance system, the system by which the federal government subsidizes insurance policies to protect farmers from bad weather conditions, has, according to the government's own audits, been led to a fiscal emergency due to the payouts related to climate change-related phenomenon. So that is actually one example that probably most people don't think about in terms of what you were saying at the opening about external costs. Those are the costs that we are now paying, we being American taxpayers in the form of crop insurance, to deal with the consequences of fossil fuels. And there are numerous examples across the board like that. For example, all the rebuilding of the levees in New Orleans and the rebuilding in New York after Hurricane Sandy, and numerous endless examples of how we are now paying the costs of climate change. But they don't appear to be the cost of climate change, which is where we kind of mislead ourselves in terms of understanding what the economics of the choices that we face are.
So you used the word external cost, and I mean, I think the big problem is that the costs of climate change are not paid for by the producers of it. So, like, you know, external costs, hidden costs, they're called externalities, but it seems like we're getting to the point where these things are no longer external, but they're integral to the entire system. So it's not like you pollute and one person gets asthma. It's like you pollute and the national budget for health care triples, and it affects everybody.
Yes, that's a really good way to put it. Exactly. You pollute, you know, we're all over the world, you have these sources of greenhouse gas pollution. And, you know, let's just go back to this notion of externalities for one second. This notion of externalities, what does that mean? That essentially means that those who create the cost don't actually pay for the cost. And so climate change is the ultimate example of what we call externalities, or what economists call anyway, externalities, which are the fact that basically fossil fuel companies profit, but we, the public, pay the costs. It's a completely twisted understanding, and it completely violates the basic principles of what we like to think of as the, quote, you know, free market. This is not a free market. This is a market. Even conservative economists are starting to understand this, that basically it's a complete twist on the market system, because we, the public, bear the risk, and the fossil fuel companies make the profits. And so once we start understanding what those costs actually are, we begin to see that the fossil fuel, the cost of that energy we get from fossil fuel companies, does not come anywhere close to reflecting its actual price and the actual damage it causes to the atmosphere. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, was to illustrate how that happened and this kind of fundamental misunderstanding of the economics at this stage.
You mentioned in the book fossil fuel subsidies, and U.S. taxpayers, of course, pay billions of dollars in subsidies that basically go to the bottom line of the fossil fuel producers' profit. Meanwhile, as you say, we're paying twice. We're paying for the subsidies, and then we're paying for the problems that these fossil fuels cost when they're burned.
Yeah. It actually, like, completely defies logic when you see how many subsidies we have been providing to the oil and gas industries. They've gone down a tiny bit in the last year, but they're somewhere around $4 to $5 billion a year in subsidies to the very industries that cause the climate problems to begin with. So we're paying billions of dollars in public money, and this is, of course, you and me and everybody else, to the oil companies to go pursue new oil explorations at the same time that we are actually paying for the consequences of using those fossil fuels on the other end. And so there's a fundamental skewing of the logic and of the market in the way that the kind of whole fossil fuel industry has been treated. Number one, subsidies that are enabling oil companies to essentially fatten their profits. These subsidies even go way back to the early days of oil, where you could actually argue back in 1900 that the oil adventurers and developers out there 100 years ago, you know, needed some kind of encouragement to go find new sources of oil. Okay. So, but that was, let's say, 100 years ago. Now those subsidies, they remain, and the Congress, which is essentially beholden to the oil and gas industries, has refused to repeal them. So we're hanging in there, actually creating the very problems with public money that that later public money has to pay for. And that, I think, is actually one of the essentially a very key point in trying to understand the choices that we face in deciding how to move forward. Because this gets central to the way in which we make decisions about how much we invest in renewable energy and other alternative sources. And if we're going to make those decisions, we actually have to have an honest assessment of what the actual costs of fossil fuels are.
Let's talk for a moment about agriculture. It's both a victim and a perpetrator, so to speak, of climate change. What are the agricultural practices that produce greenhouse gases, and what are the sectors that are most vulnerable?
Well, yes. You know, so for the book, each chapter, I have 9 chapters in the book, and each chapter I go to a different place in the world where these costs are being experienced in ways that we understand how this works. So it's all filled with stories of different places. And one of those areas that I visited was not far from where I live. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. About 3 hours south of here is the Central Valley of California, which is essentially the food-growing center of the United States. This is where a huge amount of the nation's nuts and fruit and vegetables come from. It's a massive interior part of the state. Large farms, mostly large farms, and mostly traditionally grown farms. I mean traditional, the way they say traditional, farms that are large and use and are reliant on agricultural chemicals, factory farms. And I wanted to go there to see how these big, big, big mother farms are affected by climate change. And so, number one, you actually see two edges here, because on the one hand, farmers are major contributors of greenhouse gases through primarily the use of agricultural chemicals, which take an enormous amount of petrochemicals to actually manufacture, through the emissions that come from tractors and cars and trucks, and from the unearthing of greenhouse gases from the earth when the earth is tilled, and also, by the way, the application of fertilizers. One of the greenhouse gases that gets less attention these days is nitrogen oxide, which is actually emitted as fertilizer, as nitrogen-based fertilizers age, and you can actually see spikes. It's actually incredible. I've seen these graphs where scientists have figured out that there are spikes in the atmosphere of nitrogen oxide, a greenhouse gas, during the planting season when farmers in this country as well as around the world, but very heavily in the United States, apply nitrogen-based fertilizers to the land. It ends up in the atmosphere, disrupting the climate. So you have several sources of greenhouse gases coming from agriculture itself. The flip side of that is, of course, that farmers are at the front line of these changes. How do farmers conjure food? You know, they conjure food from sun, water, soil. All three of these ingredients are being profoundly impacted by climate change. And when I went up and down the Central Valley many times and I spent time with various farmers there, what was really amazing was to hear from these people who had been farming for two, three, sometimes four generations in the Central Valley. Many of them came from Basque country and other parts of Europe, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and now are growing 4,000 or 5,000 acres of cantaloupes and tomatoes and peaches and cherries. And what they are seeing is weather patterns unlike any they've seen in the past. There are a number of things that are happening. Number one, it's warmer. It's warmer. The sort of march of the heat is moving north, so that actually plants and crops that were actually bred for way, way south in the Central Valley, they're finding that actually 100 miles north of those areas is where those kind of plants are most particularly adapted because the heat is moving northward. So you have a big change in the heat. You also have a very interesting thing I didn't know about till I was researching this, which is the importance of chill. When tree fruits, like, for example, peaches and very vividly cherries, ripen on a tree, what's essential to that ripening process is that in the wintertime it gets cold. So during about December, January, for about 4 to 6 weeks there, it gets cold enough that a budding cherry goes into kind of a hibernation so that metabolically it slows down so that basically 2 months later when it starts getting sunny and spring starts coming, when that kind of rush of ripening comes out, it comes at you with full force. I mean, it's a way of preserving the plant's energy. And what they've found is that the amount of chill in the tree fruit field, which is the northern part of the Central Valley, cherries as well as peaches and other kind of tree fruits is diminishing, and there's not enough chill. So I went to some cherry farms, for example. Cherries are very, very sensitive to these conditions, and you're finding basically trees that once were filled with those kind of resplendent, beautiful, you know, white blossoms, giving us these ripe California cherries. The cherries are coming out distorted. They're actually coming out smaller and less plump than they used to, and the yields have been dropping. And a lot of agricultural experts are saying that's because of the lack of low chill. So if you want to start to understand the costs of climate change just in this area, let's talk about the impact that has. Let's just take the cherry, for example, one crop that we all can appreciate at various times of the year where yields have been dropping, the quality of the cherries in parts of the Central Valley declining, which means that the supply of cherries is going down, which means the price goes up, and a whole series of economic consequences happen from there. So basically, if you want to extrapolate, you could take your cherries and extrapolate that to many other crops and many other kind of facets to this whole picture. So I tried to kind of get really right down into the sinews to understand how these economics were working in this era of climate change. And we haven't even touched water.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you about next. I mean, water is a huge factor in all of this because when the climate warms, water evaporates, there's less water, sea levels rise, and water is used not only for agriculture, but also for fish and wildlife. And when it decreases, there's problems there. And it's used, which I didn't know, to explain this to us, basically to sort of push back rising ocean levels.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty amazing act of an attempt to hold back the rising seas. So there are a number of aspects to the water. We could start with the ocean, if you like. Basically, as we all know now, the sea is rising steadily as a result of the planet warming and the glaciers melting, and it's pretty clear what's happening. In the area around the San Francisco Bay, in this area in the Pacific, we're looking at basically a 1.5-foot rise by 2050, somewhere around there. And what's interesting is it gets into particularities of water. So I want the water dynamics in California. I won't go into too much detail, but basically, the overall picture is this: that essentially, the water falls in the north as snow. Basically, it's supposed to happen in the winter. Then it kind of flows down the mountain types and nourishes the southern part of the state, which is much drier. But the ocean is rising. Right. And the place where the fresh water is channeled down to the southern part of the state is called the Sacramento Delta. And the Delta is this fantastically biodiverse, rich area that's where the kind of salt water and fresh water mix. But to actually maintain the high level of freshwater purity, you can't have a lot of salty water, you know, diverted down to the farms in the south. And so what they've begun doing the state of California has had to use massive quantities of the fresh water coming in off the mountains to hold back the rising seawater. And so you literally have this battle of the waters struggling it out right in the Sacramento Delta. And I will go to the place where there's this line, they call it the X Line, which is right near a town called Antioch in the Sacramento Valley, where this monumental underwater battle is taking place between the fresh water trying to hold back the rising seawater. And if you imagine that as an image of what we're all going to face in different forms, we're going to face this. We're going to face this intrusion of salt water into our freshwater supplies. And I think that that image, that X line in California, really captures what's essentially happening all over this country and around the world when it comes to the rising sea levels. At the same time, putting an extra squeeze on the water system in California is you actually have less rain. You have, number one, less rain when it's supposed to rain, and when it's supposed to snow, which theoretically would keep water preserved in ice form, right, in the cold months, December, January, February, cold months, water used to come as snow. Then by April, May, June, it would melt and go to the sort of drier parts of the state. Well, now it's not getting cold enough in the atmosphere, so the water is not falling as snow in January. It's actually falling as rain when it does fall, which means it doesn't get cold enough to turn it into snow. So all that water, farmers don't need it in December because it's raining plenty. When they need it is May, is just rushing off into the oceans and unused by agriculture. So you have a double whammy here in the state of California, and needless to say, you've had all across this country in the last couple of years some of the worst drought conditions in history, which across the board scientists attribute at least partially to the impacts of climate change. How does that translate economically? Just to understand what that means, number one, it forces every farmer, both in this state and also around the country, to either fallow their land, right, which means they take it out of production because they can't get the water, or at least in this state, in California, if they can't get the water, they can buy water from private water banks, which have been very cagey developers, have figured out how to buy water rights over the last, like, 10 or 20 years. And that water is about 3 to 4 to 5 times more expensive than the water that had been coming from this kind of federally and state-subsidized water system. So suddenly you're paying 3 or 4 or 5 times more for your water, which means we pay that much more for our food.
Let's switch gears now and look at the producers of climate change. What sectors of the global economy are the greatest producers of carbon? What industries? Is it mostly private industry?
Well, you know, it's funny, actually. We have this kind of amorphous sense that climate change is happening from, you know, all these different places, and it's hard to get a handle on, and just so big, and of course, to some extent, that's true because it is produced in from all these different locations. But it's very interesting. There was actually a study that came out earlier this year in a peer-reviewed journal called Climatic Change, which is reviewed by scientists, and was published and actually concluded that 2/3 of the greenhouse gases in the world are produced by only 90 companies. 90 companies are responsible for 2/3 of the greenhouse gas emissions on this planet. So we actually know their names. We know who they are. We know where they're located. We know their corporate headquarters. Many of them are American. Many of them are also, I've got to say, Russian, Chinese, European, and a couple of South African companies and Indian companies. But the preponderance are the kind of major big multinational oil refiners and coal companies. This is at the top of the list. So we know who they are, we know what they're doing, and we know that they've been getting an incredible deal for the past 200 years, which is basically not having to account for the actual cost of their products. So the question is, how do we begin taking that money that we've been handing over to the fossil fuel companies and instead paying the costs ourselves down the line and shifting that direction of those investments in towards more renewable energy? And that's the fundamental question we face. And it's also why I wanted to write this book, was to show, to enable us to actually make informed decisions as to how we want our money to be spent over time. Do we want it to continue to kind of enlarge the profit margins of the fossil fuel companies, which is essentially what we're doing, because they're not, their costs are not reflected in their actual goods, and so they benefit and we pay later? Or do we want to take those funds, which is our money, and move them in another direction that basically not only creates more jobs and a whole new economic basis of production, but also does far more damage to the planet, which means less cost to us? And I think this is basically the fundamental question that we're facing.
Let's talk for just a moment about these 90 companies. I mean, who are they? Name a few names.
Well, Chevron happens to be headquartered about 20 miles from here. ExxonMobil, which, of course, is the largest publicly traded oil company. Shell Oil, British Petroleum. Then you've got some Russian companies, Gazprom. And you've got Elf, which is a French oil company, and on down the list. You've also got some Indian companies, and you've got some American and African coal extraction companies as well. And, of course, the Chinese National Petroleum Corporation, which I believe is the biggest oil company in the world, as well as a whole host of Chinese coal extraction companies. So these are, for the most part, familiar names to us, other than the Chinese, Indian, and South African companies. But I would say the dominant forces on that list are American and European.
So what systems have been set up and could be set up so that the producer of the problem pays for the damages it causes? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, if you dump your garbage in my driveway, you know, how could we set up a legal system so that you have to clean it up?
Yes, that's a very, I like that, actually, except I'm dumping it in everybody's driveway at the same time. But I like your analogy. It's actually a pretty good one.
Well, it's like maybe a better analogy is if you dump garbage in the local reservoir.
Yes, that's probably good because we all rely on that reservoir. So the question right now is to how do we get the companies to, number one, stop dumping in the reservoir, because that's what they're doing, and two, move away from this kind of reliance on fossil fuels. So basically the efforts, and this is central to the global climate negotiations that have been going on for the last 20 years. The world has been trying to address this issue. How do we discourage the dumping in the reservoir? In the reservoir, which is the Earth, of course, the Earth's natural systems. And the primary ways that we are trying to deal with this now is through establishing a price for carbon that reflects its actual costs. And this is what a lot of the negotiations are all about. And there have been really the main effort that we're most familiar with in terms of the experience so far is this idea of cap and trade, which I know has a ring of, oh, my God, cap and trade. But basically, before we just throw it off the cliff, just to basically understand what cap and trade is this idea of giving industries emission limits to reduce their emission limits. And if they are emitting over those limits, they have to then go purchase the right to pollute. Right. This is the basic idea. So the idea is to give carbon a price that reflects more of its kind of damages to the environment by establishing this price for carbon. This was invented, by the way, by the United States. It was back in 1997, which was the beginning of real global negotiations on climate. First time all the world had gotten together to try to create an international agreement. And what was interesting is at that time, as climate change knowledge was increasing, the European Union and the world's developing countries were allied, and they were allied on the idea that there would be a carbon tax, that there would be a levy put on the extraction of fossil fuels that would then be used to channel money to changing the energy grid of the rapidly growing developing countries and to begin promoting the use of renewable energy in the developed countries, Europe, United States, et cetera. So Al Gore, our vice president at the time, of course, for the Clinton, representing the Clinton administration, came to Kyoto and actually said, no way are we going to do a tax the only thing that we in America will find acceptable is to subject these pollution to the forces of the market. And the forces of the market are the supply and demand of these kind of pollution credits. And so the world, rather than lose the United States, this is at that time, agreed to go along with the American plan, which was this plan for cap and trade. 4 years later, George W. Bush was elected president, and one of the first things he did in coming into office was withdraw the United States from the Kyoto process, thereby doing two things. One, removing the United States from essentially having any influence on global climate negotiations, and two, leaving the Europeans to execute what was largely an American plan, which was this kind of cap-and-trade idea. So we've now had about 9 years of experience of the cap-and-trade at work in the carbon markets, primarily in Europe. We have now a small one here in the state of California. And we're talking now about a multi-billions of dollars in this market now moving into carbon transactions. But the one thing that it has not succeeded in doing is shifting investment decisions significantly in a renewable direction because the cost has been so low.
Oh, my goodness.
The cost has never gotten really above like $10 a ton in any significant way. So there have been a lot of problems with this whole cap and trade approach, which I write about in the book.
Right. I guess it's confusing to the layman, to most of us, I think, when you're trading carbon. I mean, if you're trading corn, you know, if you're buying commodities, you know what corn is, and eventually there's an ear of corn. When you're trading carbon, what are you buying and selling, and what is the effect of that? It's hard to understand.
Yeah, it is. It's hard to understand because it takes an enormous leap of faith and, to some extent, the normal currents of logic. But it basically, what you're doing when you are investing in a carbon permit, because about a 25% of that market, by the way, is speculators. Right, they're like arbitrage, you know. They're like commodity speculators, and what you're betting on is the price of something going away. So if you're involved in the pork belly market, for example, you want to invest in pork bellies, and you can go get a ton of pork bellies tomorrow. You could, you know, if you're inclined, go invest in pork bellies on the Chicago Climate Exchange, and if you decide not to sell that investment, you will at some point get delivered a ton of pork bellies. You know, greet the truck pulling into your driveway with the pork bellies. If you invest in carbon, you are investing in a ton of a commodity that's largely been invented, and you're investing in making something disappear. So you're actively not obtaining delivery of carbon in any form. You're actually investing in the concept of making it disappear, because the theory is that by lowering the emission limits over time that the companies need to kind of buy their pollution credits for over time, the need actually for the carbon market itself will no longer be essential because we will have moved away from fossil fuels to begin with. And this is the theory that sort of underlies the notion of the carbon markets and has been found to be very, very, very volatile. It sounds very elegant. It's like we buy and sell pollution credits, and it sounds very elegant and very kind of market perfect. But in fact, the market has turned out to be so incredibly volatile, and the shifts in production patterns so enormous that the actual price on the market has been really very small, and it has also been vulnerable to manipulation, and that which has really undermined its integrity.
Not to mention organized criminal activities.
Exactly, organized crime activity, which has actually skimmed billions of dollars off a market that is supposed to be working to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.